This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. As always, my co-host, Steve Smee, is joining me.
Hey, what's up, guys? Good morning.
It's actually 8 p.m., but that's okay. we got a really good guest.
Whatever works.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Scott Stevenson.
Thank you, guys. Scott is fine. The whole Dr. moniker thing is, it just gets in the way of communication, I found, for the most part.
Well, the reason I said doctor was because I posted that photo on my Instagram this morning, right? That says Dr. Scott Stevenson will be on Evolutionary Radio tonight. I had like 10 people send me Instagram messages saying, is that guy actually a university professor? And I was like, yeah, like he has a PhD. And they're like, oh my goodness, I couldn't imagine like walking into a class and having this super muscular guy be like, well, I'm going to be your instructor today, guys.
Well, I was an exercise physiology professor. I literally was a assistant professor for a while, so it kind of made sense to a certain degree. But yeah, there is some Darren Willoughby's another guy. Hold on, I'm about to get maybe said hello here. I'm making a formal podcast. I can't really have a conversation right now. I can't talk to you at all. I'm on a professional meeting. Sorry about that. I knew that was coming. I'll talk to you in a little while. I'm here at a basically a dog-oriented bed and breakfast. So my neighbors came up to say hello. I knew that was going to happen. So sorry about that. People who listen to my podcast know there's always a dog activity in the background.
I got Mike Izzertelli coming on the podcast a little bit later. So he's a professor. He's pretty muscular as well.
Yeah, same thing. Darren Willoughby, I was going to mention, who's down at Texas Women's University, is a big cat. If you don't know who he is, he's got an Instagram site. He said, I think he had a hip replacement, to be honest, but he's a national level super heavy bodybuilder. He's been competing for decades. Real big guy. So there are a few of them out there.
So anyway, Scott, the reason I want to get you on this show is you're an expert when it comes to human growth hormone. It's a very misunderstood drug. I personally think it's much more of a lipolytic and recovery drug than is a muscle building drug. I was wondering if you could kind of give us the rundown of, you know, what exactly is human growth hormone, what it's good for, who should be supplementing with it, what types of dosages, like kind of just start going off on human growth hormone and we'll give you feeder questions.
You're looking for a GH rant of some sort, it sounds like. Well, I would agree with you first and foremost that its main job or main thing that's been that's pretty well established beyond any question is that it is in individuals that are fully formed, so to speak, that are adults. Its main action is a metabolic one to enhance lipolysis. There's not really good literature suggesting that it enhances protein synthesis in skeletal muscle, or at least myofibular protein synthesis. It does seem to be helpful for connective tissue, and this is why there's so many people that will find that it's helpful for injuries and rehab when joints, tendons, ligaments have been involved. It's been studied for quite a long time. The main mechanism whereby it proffers growth, at least that was thought for many, many years, was that the growth hormones released from the pituitary stimulates insulin-like growth factor 1, and that's what is mediating the somatotrophic effects, so to speak, of growth hormones. So it's a somatomedian C, actually, is the old name for IGF-1, and that's comes out of the liver. That's bloodborne. But now we know that there's more to it than that. There's some IGF does go and bind in bone and skeletal muscle and create some local IGF-1 release. But if you look at the literature as a whole, you're not seeing any basically retardation of muscle growth if you're eliminating IGF-1 per se. That's bloodborne, that's hepatic in origin. But you do, and you can, there's a number of different models where transgenic animals, for instance, and those sorts of things that are lacking the ability to synthesize IGF-1 locally in skeletal muscle response to a mechanical stimulus, like the weight training stimulus, some sort of trauma, and then you end up running into problems. So it's really the locally produced IGF-1 that's the one that seems to be most important in the direct studies. The thing that's interesting about IGF-1 in the blood, which a lot of people will use just sort of as a surrogate measure to see whether or not they've got high quality, good growth hormone, is how much their IGF-1 goes up. And it will certainly go up. The somatomedin hypothesis is that data haven't been refuted. You definitely see one of the effects of growth hormone is to stimulate IGF-1 release. And some of that IGF-1 in adults is really, a lot of it's a matter of, it's a sort of a indirect measure of nutritional status. So let's say someone wanted to feign low growth hormone by, and now they would measure just growth hormone pulsatility. You could do, you know, much more complicated measures, more direct measures of growth hormone release in and of itself. But if someone were to just say, oh, we'll look at IGF-1, and if it's low, that would suggest the growth hormone's low. You could fake that, so to speak, by just dieting. Because when your nutritional status is low, if your nutrient intake is low, you've got a caloric deficit. You're going to have low IGF-1, and the opposite holds when you're eating a lot of food as well. So it's indicative of overall whole body protein synthesis and that sort of thing. So the rant continues here. I'm going to just keep rolling. I mean, I got one on. That's the basic.
So what you said about IGF-1 being low when you're in a low nutrient status. So would human growth hormone then be particularly beneficial in a pre-contest scenario because it would elevate IGF-1 when you're in a low calorie situation?
What you're getting at is really the kind of the quintessential question of whether the IGF-1 is simply overall representative of nutritional status, because it does vary when someone during starvation, for instance, or, you know, if you block testosterone, for instance, if you hypophysectomize animal. The question then is exactly what you're saying is, can you reverse that in some way? Can you reverse the protein synthesis loss that would happen in when you're hypocaloric by giving growth hormone, thus the effect being mediated by IGF-1? And you don't really see that, at least acutely, in the measurements. And you don't see, there's been some work done. There's an old study by Yara Shesky, I think was the name, was done at WashU, where they
weight training
adaptations in terms of muscle growth or strength. That's one of the big sort of direct studies in a scenario that would make sense. You know, growth hormones sort of known to many as an anti-aging hormone because growth hormone declines as we age. So the idea would be to replace that and see if it helps with muscle growth. You do find with replacing growth hormone for individuals who are low, because of some pituitary disorder, of course, you know, dwarfism is a whole other ball of wax here, but you do see that if people are low in growth hormone pathologically, if you replace it, you'll get an improvement in body composition. I haven't, I'm thinking offhand, there's nothing more direct than that as to whether you would see some major direct effect of IGF-1 in that sense. It would raise your IGF-1. The thing that I think, and this is sort of getting at what I think is probably going on with growth hormone, at least to some degree, the thing that's not been studied are the large amounts that people use. Replacement doses are a little bit different. Replacement doses would be on the order of like 2 IUs a day, and that's just replacing one of the growth hormone isoforms. But what, you know, people will be using pre-contest would be 5, 6, 8, 10 IUs. So that's a little bit different story. That's obviously a substantially larger dose. But what I think can possibly happen is because, especially for people who are good responders to growth hormone, if it has a really powerful lipolytic effect and allows you to burn fat more easily, more readily for whatever caloric intake you're taking in, or maybe you can eat more calories and still burn as much fat and get in shape, that in of itself is going to raise IGF-1, of course, just because of the nutrient you're taking in, but it also is going to allow you to hold on to muscle mass better because you don't have to create the same caloric deficit because you're shifting. You still have to have a caloric deficit technically some way, shape, or form, but you've ramped up lipolysis so much and it works so well that you're gonna be able to eat more. And that's where a benefit can be dieting down, for instance.
I think
the same thing holds really in the off. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what is a dosage to get those kinds of results if you're just an average Joe looking to get some results there? Would it be 2 IUs, 3 IUs a day, or would you have to run it at a higher dose?
So that's – I'm not prescribing a dose, obviously, so people know that, but that's the interesting thing. That's why this – that's why we're talking about this topic. Because there's this tremendous amount of variability as to how well people respond and what kind of dose would be needed for those sorts of things. Some of it is going to come down to whether or not they got good growth hormone in the first place. Is it really farm grade, so to speak? Or is it a black market brand? How is it stored? Growth hormone can end up being somewhat fragmented. You can have some alterations to the chemical nature of the growth hormone, which potentially could change the shape of it. So if you change its shape and you change electrostatic conformation of the molecule, it will fit in the receptor differently and would or wouldn't activate it as well as growth hormone that was produced endogenously, let's say in the same amount. So there are guys that just will use growth hormone. They've got good growth hormone. And I mean, they can 1.5, 2 IUs, they get a substantial effect. They definitely, you know, guys would talk about how they can stay, keep their body fat percentage 4, 5, 6% lower than they would otherwise, all other things being equal. Usually there's a guy who's been doing this for a while. And then there are guys who will use growth hormone that is by all accounts good. They even sometimes literally getting it from someone who's bringing it out of the back end of a pharmacy or something like that. Like it tests well. You can do a kind of a bioassay. People will inject 10 IUs and that will typically peak about 3 hours after the injection. And you can compare that elevation with what other brands or other black market sources of GH will produce. So you can get an idea, at least using the assay that they use for the blood tests, the extent to which whatever you injected increased growth hormone. Of course, that's potentially, there's a potential issue there in that if you've got growth hormone that binds well to the antibodies or whatever they're using, the immunosorbent assay that might be used to measure growth hormone, that doesn't tell you about its actual activity in the body. That just basically tells you how much of those molecules are there. And the activity could be a function of those things I just mentioned or a person's growth hormone receptor genetics. So back to your question, if someone's like a super duper responder, I mean, they might like 4 or 5 IUs might just completely change how they look. It'll make them leaner. There are also some interaction with the renin-angiotensin system. So there's a little bit of aldosterone release that will come from growth hormone release. So they'll get a little bit of water retention. A lot of times this will fill out the muscle. So they get this round look people talk about. Someone who's doing that and they stop growth hormone, let's say if they travel and they come back, you know, a big guy might drop 5, 6, 7 pounds in a week or two after he's stopped using, you know, 5 or 10 IUs of growth hormone a day, because that's how much water that would make him retain.
Okay.
So the dose that would do that, like do the magic, depends on the person. Someone who's a growth hormone responder, so to speak, will just, if they get good stuff for those guys, they'll just see, it'll almost be magical what happens to them. And then other people won't get almost anything. And the big question is to why.
Okay. So this is a question.
I think I heard you wanted to break it with questions.
Yeah, let me jump in and just ask you, because we get this question on the forums every day. Does it matter what time of the day you inject growth hormone? Like, because a lot of people say, oh, you should inject it as soon as you wake up, before you eat breakfast. A lot of people say, like Dave Palumbo, say it doesn't matter when you inject it. Just inject it at any time of the day. Is there any truth to timing of growth hormone injecting?
So here's to kind of get a grip on that question, there's a couple things that kind of need to come into the equation. One is if a person is in some way, shape, or form trying to keep from interrupting growth hormone pulsatility. So normally growth hormone's released, pretty pulsatile in nature. Females actually tend to get more pulses than guys, but you might have, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 pulses a day. And that can be triggered by lack of glucose coming in. If you happen to take a nap or if you don't eat for a while, that's why one of the reasons that sleep triggers growth hormone release, and not eating will do the same, because growth hormone is going to help with body fat. So that's the normal release pattern, is pulsatile. And typically, like an injection of growth hormone will, its pharmacokinetic profile means it'll be around in the system for like 8 hours. So if you're going to do, let's say, one injection, and you're trying to maintain pulsatility, and a lot of that pulsatility might be happening at night, then you might do it during the day. So you use up the first 8 hours of the day, and then you've got another maybe, you know, 4 or 6 hours where the body will be able to potentially reset homeostasis, and then you'd get some more release at night. What sometimes has been done with dwarfism is they'll inject at night, trying to recreate the normal diurnal pattern of greater release at night. But those are dwarfs. So that's part of the reason why people are like, well, you know, we should do it the way they do it with dwarfs, because that's where the experts use growth hormone, so to speak. You know, that's where they fine tuned the using growth hormone for medical reasons. But if you're doing multiple shots, let's say, you know, someone were to inject 1.5 or 2 IUs 3 times a day, you're going to do that. Let's say if you did it in the morning and then the midday and then before bed, you've got elevated growth hormone from exogenous sources all day long. So there's not going to be any pulsatility there, really. So that's part of the equation. So the next part that a lot of people will say, and actually I heard Dorian Yates say this. I think it was on a Joe Rogan. Was it Joe Rogan interview he did recently? I can't. I've heard of so many Joe Rogan podcasts and so many Dorian Yates interviews. I can't remember where exactly I heard it, but what he said when he used growth hormone, and it was pretty cool just to hear this from him, because this is the word on the street that's been around for, you know, at least a decade that I know of, is that some guys, if they're trying to use growth hormone, and this basically harkens back, as far as I can tell, perhaps to a mechanism that's IGF-1 related. If they're trying to use growth hormone during the off season, and it seems to be something that would help them gain weight, then they would do like all their growth hormone or a large part of it, like 10 IUs every other day. So instead of taking, let's say, 30 IUs they're going to use during the week and spreading that out, you know, like 5 or 6 IUs a day, they would take 10 IUs and do every other day. And for some guys, that seems to help when they're in a gaining phase with gaining weight. And that's just something that many people have reported back. Dorian figured that out on his own, which he did with a lot of things, like just tried things out. And that's what he thought. Heard that many times from many guys. Some of that might be what I mentioned before, is that if you're using 10 IUs, that's really substantially super physiological. That's, you know, I don't even know if you would get that much from someone who's got acromegaly, who's got giantism, that's growth hormone related. So in doing that, it might be something where you elevate systemic IGF-1, hepatic IGF-1, produced in the liver. And even IGF-1 that's produced locally in muscle in a way that you wouldn't otherwise with replacement growth hormone injections. And that could be, this is just total guesswork on my end, but that could be an explanation as to why some guys find that they grow better. So if you're doing, you know, a substantial amount and you're looking for fat loss, and are you doing anything more than, you know, probably a few IUs, you're probably going to be shutting down the pulsatility that is normally there from endogenous release. So it would make sense to spread that out so you've got lipolysis going on around the clock. Of course, that risks glucose intolerance. It's one of the side effects. You lose that a little bit. That's part of what growth hormone does. If you're sort of in a physiological state where you need lots of lipolysis, meaning you need lots of fat around for fuel, making the body glucose intolerant makes sense, because then glucose that will be spared by the body tissues and available for the brain. Because if your brain doesn't have the fuel it needs, the brain's dead, then that's pretty much end of the story. Game over if there's no brain doing its job. So, spreading it out would make sense for lipolysis reasons, or some people find if they're trying to grow with growth hormone, they do the larger doses like that every other day. Something along those lines is what I've heard people do with some success.
So, Scott, this is another thing you hear a lot of different viewpoints on. Do you feel you should cycle growth hormone, or do you think it's something you can use year round, assuming money is not the prerogative here, like money's not the issue?
That's another one. I'm not trying to tell anyone they should or shouldn't use growth hormone. So definitely don't. I don't want anyone to misunderstand that. I'm not trying to prescribe ways to use it.
No. We're trying to just help the people who are using it get better bang for their buck. So just imagine you're talking to, you know, our listeners who are mostly like gym rats and stuff. These aren't just some idiots, you know, that don't know what they're doing, like teenagers or something. These are guys in their 30s and 40s. So we definitely want to hear your advice. Go ahead.
Yeah, the first thing would be, I mean, if we're thinking back to gym rats, it's like, okay, do you have all the other pieces of your cake put together and perfect before you add growth hormone as the icing? That's the first thing, you know, that I would think is like, okay, how many times do you miss meals? Are you training like an absolute animal? Have you figured out how to periodize your training and all the things we may talk about if we get into the fortitude training conversation? Is your diet just absolutely dead on? And are you changing a bunch of variables? Will you know if the growth hormone is helping or not? Are you going to like start using this when you blast on a cycle of a whole bunch of other stuff, such as you're just growing like crazy? And it could be the fact that you've doubled your tren use this time when you added growth hormone. It could be the tren or it could be the growth hormone. You don't know. So basically my thought would be check and make sure you've got all your ducks lined up before you add it in. So the main thing then, as far as cycling it goes, would be look for, there's obviously, you know, some side effects, adverse health consequences. One would be the glucose intolerance. So how much that is doing, as far as, for instance, things like increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease and a myocardial infarction, that could have, you know, that would be absolute total guesswork. But that's one of the things that you see in people who are pre-diabetic, people who have metabolic syndrome, is glucose intolerance. People who have acromegaly, who have hypersecretion of growth hormone from the pituitary, they don't live very long. I think the life expectancy is in like the 40s for people. You know, Andre the Giant, everyone knew who he was, the wrestler, he had acromegaly. And Robert Wadlow was like for the longest time, he was the world's tallest man, like 8'1" or something like that. He was in Guinness Book of World Records, and he lived to be like maybe 49 or something. So, you know, what's going on there in terms of, you know, longevity? You know, you got to consider that. Does it matter if you're doing it just for, you know, 3 months on, three months off? You know, I don't know. That's a possibility. I mean, the organ growth thing is also kind of a guesswork as to whether that's coming from the combination of growth hormone and insulin and food, or it's growth hormone and insulin. Maybe it's insulin because most people are using growth hormone or going to be using insulin as well, because it's so much cheaper and readily available. You might as well use it if you're going to go the extra step and use growth hormone. So it all falls kind of on a spectrum of kind of knowledge, I think, and then concern for one's health. You know, there's a, I'll just point to my good buddy, Jordan Peters, who lives in the UK. And if you don't know who Jordan is, he was on the Muscle Minds podcast with me. That's on Advices Radio for probably the first 15. We're on another podcast, but we probably did like 20 some podcasts together. He's in the UK, and he trained by JP is his website. He's in the UK where, growth hormone and steroid use is legal. Personal possession and use of those substances is completely cool. So he talks very openly on his board about what he's done and what he hasn't done. And I recently heard an interview with him, with Ron Harris on muscular development, the Ron Line Report, I think it's called. And Jordan's just turning 30 now. He's 5'6", 250 stage weight. He's absolutely gigantic. He's one of the biggest pound for pound bodybuilders of all time. But he realizes he doesn't have the structure to be a Mr. Olympia, because I mean, he trained Sasan Harati, who just took second to Nathan D'Asha out in California. So he's trained with guys like that. He knows the guys that have all the bits and pieces. So he's recognized, he wants to get his pro card, you know, compete for another couple of years, and then he's done, because he knows what the long-term health effects are. So as far as the cycling thing goes, I think just like the same question, the same response would fit into the big picture, regardless of the question, when it comes to drug use, is where, what's the long-term plan that you have, and what are your limits going to be? Are you saying I'm going to give myself 3 or 4 or 5 years of competing at a high level where I'm, putting on, you know, slamming on the accelerator full force with my training, with my food, with my dedication. And if I can, you know, make it, then, you know, I've achieved some level and then I'm going to back off. Like, where are you going to fit all this stuff in? So if your short-term goal, if you don't really know, like a lot of guys are just like, I don't know where I'm going with this. I just really enjoy the pursuit. Then the next thing that I would suggest is, if you're not quite sure, you don't have a big picture like that, is think about, especially this pertains to growth hormone. This is more of a growth hormone specific response, I think, is, try to figure out how good of a responder you are. So if you're going to use this and do it, then, you know, do your best to get something that you know is real. Like, for instance, that somebody who got it from the same place had tremendous results and you trust them, literally, you know, short from living with them or, you know, having a camera, in their house to see what they're actually doing, you know that. And then you can find out whether you're, a responder or not, because people who respond really well, like one of the things you can see, people don't talk about this very often, but it's just something I've picked up on in conversation with some other people who've been around for a while too, is that the guys who are growth hormone responders, as I mentioned before, growth hormone is has a protein synthetic effect in connective tissue, which would include cartilage. So you'll see changes in facial features. Nose size is a big one. I've even seen guys' ears grow bigger. Some of the things that people kind of associate with this Palumboism type of thing, which kind of looks like someone that is getting acromegaly. But mainly it's sort of the facial features. People will actually, their shoe size will go up. Hands will get bigger. Those sorts of things tend to go hand in hand with someone who's just responsive to growth hormone overall. So try to do your best to isolate the growth hormone use as best you can to see whether it's going to do anything for you. Because I've seen guys that have like wiled away for years on discussion boards, like trying, you know, so-and-so dealer's growth hormone and so-and-so dealer's growth hormone. And they just, you know, they're just pissing money down the toilet because they probably just don't have the receptor genetics to.
All right. So let me ask you this.
Probably just in the wind.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, because this is another question we get asked a lot. What's your best guess? What would a 30-year-old, a 40-year-old, and a 50-year-old produce naturally? How much HGH? What's the equivalent to IUs? Like, are they producing 2 IUs, 3 IUs? I mean, because, you know, like testosterone, like an average healthy man, you know, produces, who's 30 years old, probably 150 or 175 milligrams a week, the equivalent. So what would the equivalent be in HGH? What's your best guess?
It's like normal adult production is like 1 to 2 IUs. It's pretty variable on a daily basis. So something like that.
So if you're taking...
I can't have the numbers in front of me. Yeah.
Okay. So if you're to hypothetically take 2 IUs a day, you'd shut down your own body's production in the beginning in 2 IUs? Or you're saying that you still get a pulse of your own exogenous, your own non-exogenous, but your own non-exogenous or HGH?
Yeah, for instance, if you woke up and, you know, injected 2 IUs, that would be out of your system. These blood levels will be back to normal in a matter of about 8 hours or so. And there's some variation there, too, depending on what preparation you use and whether it's...
So your body would pulse out more...
Something like that.
So, but your body would pulse out more HGH once it's out of your system.
I suspect, yeah, you would recover. That's the thing. It's pulsatile nature is happening on a time scale of just hours. Like you get, you know, pulses every couple hours if you're a woman. Because, so,
because earlier
like insulin,
you said
insulin
you should,
is something that's very pulsatile too.
Earlier you said you should inject HGH if you're looking for fat loss several times a day. So by that logic, you're missing out on the pulse if you were to do that.
If you're going to use enough, let's say that you're going to go to 5 IUs, which is, you know, definitely super physiological. It would make sense to basically increase the area under the curve there to inject that repeatedly throughout the day to spread the doses out. That's what most people find as well. You could. I haven't seen like a dose response. There's actually not a lot out there in terms of like dose response for exogenous growth hormone. So, you know, if you look at if you were to calculate the amount of fat oxidized from a 1 IU, a 2 IU, 3, 4, 5 IU growth hormone injection, does it top out? When does it plateau out? You know, it's not going to be going to like, you know, 5 IUs is probably not going to do more than, it's probably going to be what I would imagine, just sort of guesstimating here, especially given that normal physiological range is 2 IUs over the course of an entire day, probably going to max out your lipolysis. So what most people find is if they spread out a dose, it's like 5 or 6 IUs over the course of a day, that would be a better way to maximize lipolysis.
So basically, Scott, if you're using...
Sorry, go ahead. I've got to go check.
So what I was going to basically summarize is basically if you're using a low dosage, like let's say you're just using 2 IUs per day, it'd be best to do that first thing in the morning. So then that way you're not shutting down the natural HGH pulse you will get when you sleep. But if you're going to use a more significant dose, let's say 5, 6 IUs, you'd want to spread that out throughout the day. Is that basically what you're trying to say in layman's terms?
For lipolysis, yeah, that's the idea. You could do it at night too. This is why people say it doesn't matter. But I do know there is some work suggesting that the overall effect, if you look at the amount of fat oxidized, when you're given carbs or not given carbs for a given amount of IU injected, is less when you have carbs around. So injecting it while you're already semi-fasted at night when you don't have food coming in would make sense. So that's one thing that better. Guys, give me a second here. This is a brand new dog.
Sure. That was really interesting. Steve, what I want to ask, what I want to ask next is I want to ask, you know, the best method to test for HGH, you know, to determine if your HGH is real. What are some other things you want to pick Scott's brain about?
Well, I just want to mention too, you know, one of our board sponsors that sells HGH while the doctor is dealing with the dogs, which is
I'll be back soon, you guys.
Which is mailorderhgh.com, and you guys can hit myself or Trevor up on the boards for a code on that. So,
what's cool about mail order HGH is they're actually Canadian domestic. I have no idea how they get these kits in, but I've never before heard of a Canadian domestic source. I mean, every other source I've seen, they're shipping it out of China. Hey, Steve, have you ever heard of a source out of Canada?
I don't know much about that sort of thing. I don't know really much, so but that's awesome. They're really good, and they ship to the U.S. really quickly, so they're really good company. So we want to, you know.
We actually have a lot less strict peptide research chemical laws here in Canada than you guys do in the U.S. So what I suspect is it's some sort of, like, peptide company that's making the HGH when it's shut down, like when the doors are closed. That's what I would suspect.
Well, you're the chemistry guy for sure. So, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I think I'm back here. They're just going crazy because Daddy was gone. So
they
hadn't killed each other yet. So that was amazing.
Where are you, Scott? Are you on a vacation or are you on a work trip?
A new dog. One of my dogs passed about 7 months ago, and my littlest one's a little depressed. She likes to play. So I found a dog that seemed like a great match, and I'm up in outside of Tallahassee. And strangely enough, the dog that I just picked up was over an hour away from where I am, and the rescue people, when I told them I found this nice place to stay, she neglected to tell me, well, the dog's not actually where I am. The dog's an hour and a half this way, so I'm kind of out in the boonies at a bed and breakfast.
So you're in Tallahassee. What's Tallahassee, Florida? Tallahassee, Florida?
Yeah. Tallahassee, Florida.
Oh, okay. I didn't think you were American. You sound too nice to be an American. Because I'm in Florida.
Well, you...
Yeah. People are assholes in Florida.
Really?
Yeah. But you're
I'm
not American.
Midwest, so maybe that has something to do with it.
You're
I'm
Canadian.
American. Yeah. Do I sound like...
No,
I'm from the U.S. I grew up in Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Where are you?
I'm in South Florida.
Where in Florida are you?
South Florida.
Okay. Yeah.
You get cussed out by every different language living down here. I've been cussed out like 100 times.
You in Miami?
Yeah, near Miami, yeah.
I mean, I live in Tampa. I co-promote an NPC show in Miami.
Oh, okay.
So I'll be there in October. Yeah. So anyway,
I'm two hours away from you
most of the time.
I'm down in Canada, the land of maple syrup and polar bears.
Where Trevor is, it's like, you know, they're so friendly. They're so nice. Trevor's such a nice guy. So it's totally different. He'd get eaten alive.
Actually, I agree with that.
If you came to Florida, he'd get eaten alive, especially in South Florida. So Trevor wanted to ask you about the next question. Go ahead, Trevor.
So Scott, what's the best way to determine whether or not your HGH is actually real? You know, you often hear that pregnancy test method. Does that have any merit to it? Is blood work the only way you can really determine whether or not your HGH is legitimate? How can our listeners find out whether or not they actually have a good source?
The best way would be bring it to a chemist, you know, someone who has the lab equipment. To make probably an HPLC measurement, that's what you'd really want to do. The way that people will do it, the sort of the next best thing from a practical standpoint. That's funny you mentioned the HCG method, the pregnancy method. People would back a long, long time ago, people would fake growth hormone with HCG. So you could take your growth hormone or whatever you got and put it on a pregnancy test strip, and if it was HCG, which is what those strips test for, human chorionic gonadotropin, you know that your growth hormone is actually HCG. But no, what people will do is, and this has been you can find this pretty easily. There are threads on several boards where people have gone and taken whatever source they have, and they take 10 IUs. They set up a blood test where they're going to, you know, they probably get their blood chemistry and CBC and that sort of thing done as well. Or maybe they just go in to test this and they order a growth hormone test. They time the test, hopefully, so that it's about 3 hours after the injection. So they inject and then go in to get their blood taken about 3 hours later, because that's when it would peak. And then you would compare your results with other guys' results. And, you know, just realize that there's going to be some variability, you know, for the same person, for the exact same growth hormones, for the exact same amount. That is the test that a lot of people will do. It gives you kind of a ballpark. What it doesn't tell you, because like I said, those are going to be, antibody based. I think they use immunosorbent assay. So basically they're looking for proteins that are going to be binding to the growth hormone protein and measuring the extent of that. And that isn't going to tell you about some of the finer things that can happen. Oops, sorry. With oxidation, the thionine residues in particular are easily oxidized, and that could potentially cause growth hormone molecules to aggregate. They can become deamidated. You can have growth hormone, and actually the body produces these. We haven't even talked about growth hormone isoforms, but the body produces growth hormone fragments. So you could have a product that's got a lot of fragmented growth hormone in it. Meaning that, you know, the growth hormone molecule has been broken up. And if you get protein binding to an antibody, it's still going to come across as a fully functional protein. Whereas, you know, depending on how that antibody's been set up, I presume, I'm not totally up to date on the technology now, if they're making sure that they're binding the growth hormone exactly at the binding domain of the molecule itself. But you could end up having a growth hormone fragment that has the binding domain on it that sticks to an antibody that when it binds to the growth hormone receptor in the human body doesn't do anything. So you could have what was originally growth hormone that was just, you know, exposed to too much heat or sat on the shelf too long or who knows what, sat in customs for a couple months. And it shows up good on this blood assay because it's just sort of a raw test for the amount of growth hormone in your blood. But it doesn't tell you specifically about the bioactivity of that growth hormone. So it gives you an idea, but it's not going to tell you, it's not going to be the exact answer as to whether this growth hormone is going to work for you, because the product itself may have flaws despite having a good blood test. Bioassay is kind of what that is.
What about testing your fasting blood glucose? Because when you take HGH, your blood glucose level should rise. Would that be another indicator of whether or not you have good HGH?
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting the, I mean, people will kind of criticize this. If you're getting the cluster of symptoms, tunnel syndrome is what a lot of guys get from the water retention, and your fasting blood glucose is going up over time. That would tell you some, but IGF-1 is really a better marker than those two things. Some people, there's speculation that, and I don't know if this really happens. One of the thoughts was that people, instead of actually putting growth hormone in the vials, they're putting one of the growth hormone secretagogues, like pamarelin, maybe. Most of the GHRPs would increase people, the ghrelin agonists increase most people's appetite, so they would kind of know. But those will cause water retention, the same way growth hormone will. And those would cause a spike in growth hormone, but it really wouldn't overlap with that 3 hour measurement time, probably. But those would over time increase your IGF-1 levels somewhat. And that's what a lot of guys seem to rely on. And basically it's interesting because there's like this underground science, where, you know, guys are doing what bodybuilders have always done. It's like, okay, they use a certain growth hormone, then they go on for several months and they use some growth hormone at 10 IUs or whatever
supposed to be in the bottle, and they measure the IGF-1 and it goes up a certain amount. And then they corroborate that, or they pay attention to how well it's working in terms of fat loss and what they're sensing in terms of body composition changes. So for them, if their IGF-1, you know, is 350 or something like that, normally it's 200 rest, or it goes to 400. And that's typically where they're going to find they're having growth hormone that's being effective for all the other things they're looking for. Then they use that. They'll know that. And that elevation IGF-1 will happen pretty quickly, a matter of days or weeks for sure. I mean, it'll go up in a matter of days, but it actually persists for a while too. IGF-1 doesn't have, it's got a long half-life in the body. It's what the binding proteins are about. So it can stay pretty elevated for a while. So that's secondary to doing a growth hormone measurement in the blood. IGF-1 is what people would do. So you start corroborating a 3-hour post 10 IU injection of growth hormone with elevation of IGF-1, with carpal tunnel, with the roundness that people will kind of see. Over time, someone who's been, you know, doing this for years kind of starts to get a feel for what those numbers will mean for them, at least.
I got one more question, and I'll let Steve jump in again. So you often hear people say that HGH use is going to cause insulin resistance. And that's why so many people say if you're going to use HGH, you should use a long ester form of insulin with it, something like Lantus. What are your thoughts on stacking HGH with insulin? Does that become necessary if you've been using HGH for a long period of time?
I'm from a medic. It's kind of using ancillaries to band-aid a side effect of elevated estrogen. You're just drug doses that you're using. So necessary from a health perspective, I don't know. You're not improving insulin sensitivity by using more insulin. What you're doing is increasing the bioactivity, the insulin effects that insulin has on protein synthesis and especially protein breakdown. So you're counteracting any loss of growth potential from insulin insensitivity by using insulin. So that's not fixing the problem brought on by growth hormone from an insulin insensitivity standpoint. That's just making sure that you're not missing out from a bodybuilding standpoint on what insulin can do for muscle growth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're basically addressing the symptom, not the problem. Steve, do you have any questions, or do you want me to keep
going? I was going to ask the same thing. And when I use HGH, I never noticed this at all. So why do you think that is? I never noticed any hypo symptoms or anything. Do you think what could be the reason for that?
You wouldn't probably notice anything. You just see that your blood glucose is elevated. Hold on just a sec. I got a crazy dog here. Just one more second.
It also depends on the
dosage. Hey, you guys, come on.
I don't think you were using what dosage of HGH were you using?
Yeah, just like 3 or 4 I use a day.
Yeah, like the insulin resistance only really becomes an issue once you really start blasting HGH. I'm talking guys running like
that wouldn't have done anything.
And then what are the side effects of guys who are using a reasonable dose that they would notice over time? Would they notice water retention for sure? Because that's another thing I didn't really notice either, water retention.
Steve, define reasonable dosage for him.
Like under 4 I use a day.
And what would they notice as far as side effects?
Yeah, would they notice water retention, or what would be some side effects short and long term?
The things we talked about already, the water retention, hopefully you see fat loss, the carpal tunnel syndrome. Those would be the main ones. And then possibly a slow rise in your insulin, or excuse me, your blood glucose levels.
Right, but
so
the carpal...
You might find a little bit less... Go ahead.
I was going to say the carpal tunnel syndrome, that's another thing I never noticed either. Is that something that's a long-term side, or is that something even short-term? Like after a couple months you would notice?
It goes away when you stop using. It comes and goes. And that's highly variable too. There are guys that like literally they're crippled by that side effect. They literally have a kind of a physical disability because the carpal tunnel's so bad. And, you know, they like end up using splints to sleep in at night, and they put up with it a lot of times because they're finding that the growth hormone is so effective for them. So that's a sign of someone who, you know, has good responsiveness to growth hormone. You get good effects, what you're seeking, and you get also, unfortunately, powerful side effects too. But that would go away. The water gain. So once you've lost that water, which would happen in a matter of 2 weeks, probably at the maximum, faster than that for a lot of people, the carpal tunnel goes away.
Okay. And then one more.
Will drop the dose. Sure.
I have one more question about storage. We all know after you mix the, you know, HGH, you should put it in the fridge. What about in powder form? Should you still put it in the fridge in powder form? And if you're not going to mix it for a while, or does it not matter?
That makes sense to me. Yeah. It's not helping it to get a warmer temperature. If it's going to be used in a couple months, then yeah, but definitely refrigerate if you can. I wouldn't freeze it. But yeah, why not put it in the fridge if at all possible? you go grocery shopping, you got some meat, you got home at 10 in the morning, you're going to cook the meat at 6. Is it okay to leave it out on the countertop the whole day? Yeah, probably. It'd probably be okay, but why would you even risk it? You know, put it in the fridge.
It's a good analogy, Scott.
I mean, worst case scenario. Yes.
I got one more question for you. Growth hormone and thyroid function. You know, you always hear this sort of rumor going around that, you know, you need to use T4 or T3 when you're using HGH. Is there any truth to that?
Some people will find that their thyroid levels will go down. So that would make sense. The whole Anthony Roberts article on, and I can't remember the details on that. That's probably where this kind of got started, is he suggested that, you know, you're wasting your growth hormone unless you're using T4. But yeah, you'll suppress thyroid output, which is mainly T4. Thyroid, it makes kind of, there's a logic behind using T4, especially if you're like contest prep, for instance, as opposed to T3, because the T4 to T3 conversion then is regulated by your body, and it prevents you're feeding basically enough T4 in there so that you're not lacking in that substrate. And the extent to which you produce more T3 will reflect what's going in calorically, as well as carbohydrate and insulin levels. So insulin fosters T4 to T3 conversion. So instead of, like, you guys have heard this, I'm sure, many times, if someone diets down and they've got the last bit of stubborn fat, and they also, and they just start using like 50 or more micrograms of T3, and then they just eat up all their muscle. They lose, you know, 5-10 pounds of muscle the last few weeks. That issue, that wouldn't be as much of it, because the T3 basically is just turning on your metabolism. You're just putting your pedal to the metal. There's no regulation there. There's nothing keeping that metabolic effect from happening, just relative to the dose you're taking in. Whereas T4 isn't metabolic active, essentially, and T3, the T3 that's produced will be relative to your diet. So how much is there, and the elevation relative to your diet. So you're basically putting on sort of a physiological break by using T4 instead of T3, because your diet will regulate how much T3 you actually get. So a little bit safer. So anyway, that's sort of the idea behind using T4 versus T3, and T4 is what your thyroid produces. So if issue is thyroid output that's lowered because of GH, well, then you replace what has been lowered, which is T4, not T3. So that's sort of working with, to a certain degree, you're sort of treating the root of the issue, which is T4 output, not T3 conversion per se. So that's the rationale behind that.
So, Scott, we're pretty much at our hour here. What I want to ask you is, like, in real layman's terms, how would you rate human growth hormone as a drug in terms of effectiveness? You know, would you say like it's a really good tool to have in your tool belt, or would you say it's kind of overrated for the price?
That's a really good question. There's so much context to that. It's kind of like saying, how would you rate cocaine as a drug? You know, some people fucking love cocaine. Or how would you rate alcohol as a drug? Some people are drunk every day. And then, you know, I was a drinker in eons past, and I don't drink at all anymore.
Okay,
that's a good question.
I'll give my thoughts on HGH, and then you can kind of piggyback on what I say. I think HGH
is great.
I think HGH is a great drug. Like I said, you know, it's very, very good for improving recovery. Like you said, it helps improve collagen synthesis. It's a lipolytic drug, so it's very, very good for increasing fat loss. I think for younger guys, their money would be better off spent on other things, because if you're a young guy, you got a good metabolism, you know, you should be recovering well, you should be losing body fat pretty easy. I find for older guys, they really benefit from HGH, not just from those aspects, but also the anti-aging aspects. So I normally tell people, you know, if you're under 30, I'd probably just stick with, you know, gear. Like, you probably don't really need HGH. But if you're getting, you know, in your 30s, especially if you're in your 40s, I think HGH would be something you'd probably really benefit from.
Yeah, and like, I think the key thing in what you said is benefit. What kinds of benefit are you trying to get? And that's on a sliding scale too. Just being able to recover better, feel better, you know, those sort of medicinal benefits that come with an anti-aging strategy like growth hormone. Not a bad thing to have at all. Whether it's going to turn you into the next coming of Ronnie Coleman is another type of benefit that some people are going after. And I would agree with what you first said there, you know, is get all your ducks in a row. And then only then would, if you're trying to become a tremendous bodybuilder, when you know that, for instance, you've got extraordinary genetics, you're already, you know, nationally qualified multiple times in the US and NPC, for instance, you're competing at a high level, close to getting a pro card, and you've not used HGH, then you might add it in if someone were to go that route, and see, you know, whether it makes sense to them. But otherwise, it's not going to take someone who's got average genetics, who's, you know, giving an average kind of output, being a competitive bodybuilder, and all of a sudden just transform them. In most cases, every once in a while, someone will get sort of a magical effect, but for the most part, no. You'd already know that because you'd be responsive to many other things, the food, the training, other drugs, for instance.
Scott, we got one more question for you.
Oh, good question.
We got one more question, and then I'm going to close up the show. So this was a listener question that was sent to me on Instagram. He wants to know your thoughts on the growth hormone gut. Is that a real thing in your opinion, or are the guts actually due to insulin?
So there are animal data, and you'll see this with acromegaly too, that hypersecretion of growth hormone increases growth, organ growth. So there's something to say physiologically for that possibility. God, there's some guys, like there's a guy, I don't want to say his name, I don't like try to pick on some people, but he's sort of he's an internet celebrity just because his gut is so gigantic. I think actually maybe he lives in Florida too. I'm not sure, but it's just like ridiculous. So what is probably going on there, aside from organ growth, which could be brought on by growth hormone, is when you have someone who's using a lot of insulin, for instance, to become insulin sensitive, you find that there's going to be a lot of visceral fat that can be produced. So you end up with body fat there, visceral body fat, that will stay in place until that insulin sensitivity is restored. So I think what may be happening, this is sort of the cycle that I'm imagining, is that guys who are the biggest bodybuilders in the world, we're talking, you know, pros here, who have been run into that issue, have several things that are going on. One, they've got to eat tremendous amount of food. So there may be even some impacted colon type of scenarios here where they've just got like literally a fecal accumulation that's contributing to this. They're probably using both insulin and growth hormone. So they probably have good genetics for having low subcutaneous body fat in the first place. So over the course of their off season, they spend most of the off season or whenever they're growing with a full belly using both insulin and growth hormone, which could be potentiating the stuff in their colon, just literally having the abdominal musculature on stretch like that. Muscle will reset from the actin-myosin overlap. The sarcomere links will reset based on sort of the habitual muscle length. Like if anyone's ever casted their arm in a shortened position, it takes a while to get that range of motion back. Some of that's because the muscle has literally shortened, the connective tissue shortened. The opposite happens when you're constantly full. You constantly got a food baby. So that's going to lead to lack of ability to control the, just neurologically, not to mention the muscle stretched out, the midsection. And then you've got the possibility that these guys have accumulated visceral fat more rapidly, maybe because they're using like Lantus and high doses and lots of insulin. Then they may even try to keep doing that with more enough growth hormone. They can still get lean and they don't drop the Lantus or the insulin as they're dieting down because they've got Zogenix to allow them to get lean, at least in subcutaneous fat. But what's lagging behind is the visceral fat. So they got some visceral fat, maybe a small amount of organ growth, a large gut, stretched out, midsection musculature. And they haven't posed, practiced, and posing is a bitch. Posing is really, really hard, keeping your midsection flat. So they haven't practiced that. So their gut's hanging out. So I think my guess is that when you see those extreme cases, it's not just one thing. We so many times we're reductionistic and we want to like point the finger at like one particular cause. It would make it easier to understand, but I think it's probably kind of multifactorial. And those are the things that, you know, probably are in varying degrees are playing a role in different people. I know one pro, he doesn't compete anymore, but he had, he just had like chronic colitis. And his gut was always bloated, and he was criticized for having a bloated, like a roid gut or a GH gut or a slim butt gut or whatever you'd call it. And literally it's because he just so easily he could eat something that would bloat him. And he was always bloated like that. So he literally had a medical condition. And that's a possibility. And I talked to him in person. I had lunch with him at a show where he guest posed. So, there's a multitude of things that could be. Those are my best guesses as to what's playing a role.
For your host, Trevor Kuritson, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, Dr. Scott Stevenson, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm.